Lexington.
Lexington.
1962 at Fairbanks, Alaska, at a meeting of the Seminole Yukon Historical Society.
Wait.
In the Boyce Park Recreation Hall.
Does that go on now?
And Mr. Ben Falls is our speaker tonight.
Mr. Reed will make the introduction. Mr. Reed?
This is a talk by Mr. Ben Falls on March 22nd, 1962 at Fairbanks, Alaska, at a meeting of the Historical Society. Mr. Falls, when did you come to urban mining in Livengood for many years?
Yes, sir.
And you were mining right across the creek from the town of Livengood?
Yes, sir.
What was that creek? I've forgotten it.
Called Ruth Creek.
Ruth Creek. When did you go there, mister?
I went over there in 1716.
When was the creek discovered?
Well, I believe it was 1914 when it first stampeded over there. But they didn't really find the fish creek that was back in the benches. That happened to be later, 1916 anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And the first St. Peter's was over there.
Will you have to speak just a little louder?
Well,
talk a little louder, please.
I see. Well, I couldn't tell you exactly, you know, but the first stampede started in 1914, if I'm mistaken. From that on, we're over there and back. We didn't think there was anything worth staying for, and I met a lot of them coming back and said there's no good over there, but that's the time I generally keep going on, you know. So I'm there yet. I mining ever since. But when I first went over there, I wasn't exactly mining. I started to help build a town up. And a little later on, I got looking around for a lay, and I took a lay up in Lillian Creek. That's the next creek around there, the road crosses it. And I was put in 3 years on that creek and opened it up, but I didn't make very much money. I took too short a lease. I guess I didn't know enough to have it longer. I'd have made more money than I did. But at that, it was too easy for the owner, so I didn't get an extension on the lay, and I went over onto this roof quick that you asked me about, and I started there. Well, I spent 10 years on that creek, and I done pretty well. I guess I took out $100,000 off of that creek. Well, it took me a long time to take it out, about 10 years, so you don't get very much money at one time. And I got outside, and my wife met me in Seattle, and come back in, and we built home up there. And after that, the war came on, and everybody started to leave the country, and I think the railroad's building about that time. And I was leave Roof Creek, and I went up to Wilbur Creek. I'd been there on account of there was very little water on them short gulches. And there was lots of water up on Wilbur Creek, where I went up there and I tried that creek after there were three stampedes on that creek. And the last one, they even quit that one, but there was a little gold found at the mouth of the creek. And I followed that up into the benches and started up again. And there's been very much taken out of that, except two claims that worked there at the mouth of the creek. Then we have lots of coarse gold, and looks good to me yet, that far. There's nobody doing anything more on it. And I think I'm starting quite a bit ahead of my story. You were going to ask me where I was born or something else, was it?
Well, you might give a history of your life.
Well, yes, I can catch up with this. I was born in Ontario, Canada. My wife was born there, too. We were both in the same neighborhood. And I came west when I was about 18 years old, and that was in 1898. I came west to Vancouver. I worked there in the sawmill for a while, and that summer, 1898, I signed on a British reserve ship, Navy reserve ship, and I went to China. I went routed by Japan through the MNPs and across the LSE to Shanghai and down the coast to Hong Kong. And that year was the summer due we took Manila while we were there. The news come from Manila by some boat or other, we didn't know, but the cables were at Hong Kong to get the news to the world. On our way back, we stayed there 8 days, as much as say. On our way back, we took about the same route back again, across the LSE. There was a typhoon hit us there, and I was something terrible for about 4 hours. Anyway, we reached Nagasaki early in the morning, just as the sun was coming up, outside the harbor. There were two big battleships come out there. That was built by Britain, you might say, the finest battleships in the world. They come out there, and we bypassed them, you know, and they were playing the Maple Leaf forever. Struck me, I said, how did they learn to play our music? We went on into the harbor, and inside the harbor there was every nation of Europe that had a fleet, had one of their fleets in there. One of the greatest sights, I guess, I ever will ever seen or will see. Well, they were all neutral ships. That was there were only Spain and the United States that wasn't allowed in that harbor. They were at war at that time. Well, we were on our way back, so when I got back to Vancouver again, I thought I was a pretty good sailor. At that time, I went back to the shops, the CPR shops where I'd worked before. There for a while, I went back to the shops, and I stayed there for the next spring, and then I hired out with W.D. Hovis and Company that hired a certain amount of Canadians, you know, to go up with Americans up there to build the river boats that was built in 1901 at Whitehorse. There we built three fine boats there, and that summer was over, and I went over back out to Chilcat to build a cannery out there. Nice and warm out there. Quite a bit warm was up in Whitehorse in winter time. In the spring, I come back and up to build a boat. They called it the Kaikuk boat, and so it was a light draft river boat that would take up a load of grub way up to the Kaikuk strike of the battles. I was a captain on that. When we got to battles, I reported the big heavy nuggets up there at Hammond River, and I took a call for the small boat, and we pulled up to a place called Coldfoot at that time. It's not mentioned anymore. I guess took it away and they moved it up to Wiseman Creek. Well, I stayed around that summer and I prospected. And in fact, it was a pretty hard country to live in, and everything was high. I met up with a couple of men and they wanted to go out, and they thought if I was going out on this boat, they'd go with me. But we were down there for some few days together, and we decided we'd come out overland by the way of Dawn River, that's now called Stephen Village. And it took us 9 days to get out over there. And we first got off the hills and down to the flats there. We crossed about 20 miles flats, I guess it would be. And there was hundreds of lakes. You'd go around one lake, and you'd come right back around another one. Wiggled our way out till we got to the Yukon. Millions of ducks and geese hatched over there every summer. Waters are dark and deep too. We didn't have any ammunition left by the time we got there. We shot one duck, you know, but nobody wanted to go out and swim out and get it. It was pretty short of grocery, pretty short of grub anyway. But we got to the Yukon, and another fellow by the name of Batchmore, I don't know where he lived today, but he was about the same age as I was. And we took a small boat that was sunk in the sand there. We dug it out and patched it up, and we floated down the rampart because we'd heard about the strike up in the Tanana. We was at rampart there till February. And there was somebody had taken a dog team run up to see how that strike was. And they come back and said it was sold. There was gold up there, but they didn't say how much or anything, but it started everybody to go. And when I got to Keelan, and that was in winter. And that was in winter 1902 and 1903. And there was quite a lot of people was ahead of me, of course. I was got to Chino. And there they started to build a town of Chino right along the bank, log houses going up. And the store was up here. The Barnett's boat and everything was up here. That is in the trading port here. In the log cabin, maybe about as big as a Sirius. And all the groceries and everything was in there. And he told them all out pretty quick, of course. Everybody was coming in and stayed till here in the town and down in Chino. Nobody hardly went out to see what was all over in the creeks. But my partner went over to the creeks and he looked around there and went up to see the ones that were taking out a little dirt on Pedro Creek. And that wasn't Pedro, but I think it was John Conto, an Italian man, and somebody was his partner there. But anyway, my partner said they only had about 5 cent dirt. Well, he come from Rampart, this fellow that was with me, he come from Rampart, and he said, "I don't see anything worth staying here, Ben." He said, "It was 5 cent dirt." He said, "We can go back down to Rampart." Well, I bought a horse, and when we tried to go back down the Rampart, the snow was so deep and soft that we couldn't get through. It was getting too long for spring, you know. And he went on with his little sleigh, and I came back with a horse. And there was about 100 horses down here around Chino and up here that didn't have nothing to eat. There was no hay, but the horses I had, I went out on that there lake back at Chino, and there was a scoop shovel. I got underneath on the ice there, and I scooped off a lot of this wild grass that grows around the lake, you know. Some of it was green. And we shook that out and put it in the gunny sack, carted it back in over to where I had a horse blanketed up. I didn't even have a table for him, but in a box I put a little flour on that and some salt or push butter with some hot water or something. Stirred up and I saved my horse from all the rest and died. And I thought I was pretty lucky. Well, I had that horse prospect all summer. You know, that spring there was hundreds of people here that some of them had got back, but the dog teamed over the trail, but those that didn't have a chance to go back, they stayed here and they built rafts and went down out of this country just as fast as they could get out of here. And it just began to show me that people didn't know what they'd come here for. They didn't go out to see what was on the creek. They just wanted to see if the town was going to boom for them or something, and they were all ready to go, and they left on rafts and everything went down. And summer was kind of quiet for a while, so I met a man that was from down from Dawson, but he had come from Rampart up through the flats up there by Lake Minto and up that way, and had in the wintertime he was out here and looking for this country, a livelihood country. And he came over, he heard these spike over here. People had a store over here, so he came over here to get some groceries. And he said to me, he says, "You got a horse?" He says, "You'd like to go over with me?" He says, "I think we'll find a good country over here." Well, I went over with him, and we had 5 or 6 followers for the first time, but we made a sashay round Wickersham's Nome and over that beam came back and didn't go very far. Some of them went home before we got halfway out, and we finally come back, and this man, his name was Patterson. He was a Canadian man from Dawson. He was probably as old as 65 years old, but he's pretty husky. And I was just maybe about 23 or 4, something like that. And started off on another trip, and we went up by the way of Pedro. There was a trail up that way, but no road then. But we climbed the hill, and we got on top of the hill there where we met Frank Manley, and he was over on Clary Creek, and he was sinking some holes on 5 below. He worked early as March, and they had just finished there, and Frank asked us where we were going. We said we would go out and see if we could find a good country. And now he says, if you boys find anything, he says, be sure and stake me in, he says, and I'm sure you get anything you want when you come in. Oh, he said we would, and we went on. But he told us to go down as far as his cabin down in Fife, where there was the deserted bullet holes were there, and he'd moved up the Discovery. Well, we stopped in his cabin, and there was nothing there but his harness, but anyway, it was raining that time, and we thought it was pretty good, save us pitching camp. We went down to his cabin. Well, about 2 days, about all I could stand of it. The weather began to break a little bit, still raining. The fire had gone through that part of the country, and it burned all the spruce trees black and picked everything up, and started to grow a lot of nice grass around there, so I turned my horse loose on that and had to have hobbles on it, of course. And by the second day, I was looking around to see where the last stake was on the bench, first year bench. And I didn't want to stake anybody else's claim, and it was all burnt, but I come to a tree that was blazed upstream where they had staked, but they didn't blaze the downstream side on the bench. Oh, I said, here must be the last claim. So I started to stake this claim when my partner came out and took me away from him. He says, I think we better pack up and go now, man. He says, it's clear enough. We've been here long enough. I said, I thought I'd stake a couple of claims here, John. I said, here's the last tree up here. It took me quite a while to find it. And, oh, he says, I think we better pack up and go on. He says, we can stake on the next creek over here. Well, you know, after we were out there in the Beaver for about 6 weeks, and went back again, it was getting towards fall. You know, Franklin Manley and his two partners, Jesse Noble and something named Roth, why, they were taking out $2,600 for the windlass in a week's time over there on Clary Creek, you know. And by to finish my bench claim, I'd have had $1 million claim. But this didn't happen this way. I've had quite a few, three or four opportunities to have a good claim, but I just didn't seem to have the right kind of a partner to stay with me. But I wanted to sink a hole someplace and thought we'd find something. He might say, oh, this is a moose pasture. Want to do nothing about it? I had number 7 down here, sink a hole for a half in it. My partner says, oh, why, this is too wide, he says, and pretty deep. He says, I don't think we'll ever get the bedrock here. Well, that was right on top of that money. The man that sold it, Gus Conrad is one of the men now, and he had a partner named Jimmy Oldfield. They owned that claim. They offered me the half interest for to sink one hole to bedrock there, and they sold it to a colored man that came down to Boston for $800, and he sold one half for $8,000, the other for $40,000. I never put a pick in it. And it was a religious claim they had down there on Nestor Creek. The Berry Brothers, I guess, took most of that money out, but the rate had been down there. Never. Well, these things, you know, never discouraged me. I didn't worry myself about anything. Just kept it going. But the Livegood stampede was the last chance I had. And when I went over to Livegood, why, people were leaving there again, you know, just like to do with the other stampede. They'd go away and then they'd come back again. But Livegood has not been the prospect of very good yet. They quit that country when their war broke out and nobody ever come back. And I don't know whether I'd better keep on with my...
Go ahead, that's very interesting.
This thing is going on the tape here. Well, anyway, I don't want to talk about that, but I was doing some prospecting up the Chattanooga River in 1910, it was. Stone Creek was pretty lively over there at that time. And a fellow told me, he says, I hear there's somebody up the Chattanooga River, he's just got some pay up there. He says, and the fellow's got some horses. We had a horse or two. And he'd go up there and with me, and we'd find this creek. We went up on one creek, and I think, if I ain't mistaken, it was the next creek to this way from Sourdough, called a creek up there. But we spent there about a month, and seeking hold on that creek. We didn't find a color, and we decided to give it up. My partner says, I think we better go catch a few fish last 2 days we had finished our holes over there. So he went out to, with the rod, there was only one rod between us, so he went out on the river and went to fish. And I just flew around there and I thought I'd go across the river. It wasn't very deep. And I see a new stake over there and I wanted to get up over there and see who that staked up that out there. And I come to a slough, you know, and that had made water from the river, like. And I couldn't just cross it right there, so I thought I'd maybe go up a little ways where I could find a place to cross it. And you know, I see about 1,000 grayling in that slough. And they all raced up the slough, you know, to get away from me. And I kept walking along, and they were going. Pretty soon they started to rile the water up. They went into a little narrow place there, and I said, my goodness, I said, I've never seen so many fish. But I went back to get my gum boots on, so I could go in there and see if I could catch some with them. I couldn't see them anymore, so I took the bucket and I just was fish out the muddy water and everything, and I kept getting a fish or two till I got enough. So I had a bucket book and I went back home. My partner hadn't caught a fish. He was up and down the river 2 miles and he hadn't caught a he said he hadn't got a bite. So I said, well, maybe you don't know how to fish, Jack. Oh, yes, I do, he said. Well, I think I'd take out the rod and try it myself. And he was kind of a sour fellow. He wouldn't talk to me half the time anyway, but I said I would go try it. Oh, he says, you won't catch anything. He says, I never got a bite, he says. Well, I could try it anyway. So I went out and I stuck the rod behind the tree and went on over, you know, with this bucket and got in there with my gum boots and got this nice little bucket of fish. And I came back, but I didn't want to come back too soon. But when I came up there, well, he says, you didn't get any, did you? Why? I says, I got all kinds of fish here. Oh, he says, I've never seen anybody catch so many fish in my life. He says, you haven't been gone only about an hour and a half. But you know, I thought it was too good to tell him, but we'd. Every time you meet somebody when we were coming home, you had to tell them that story. But you know, I'm not talking about the funny story about this, but I think the wildlife and game fellows really haven't seen anything like that. And they might arrest a man for fishing if he didn't have a license. But you know, but then I went back there just the last day before we were going, about 3 days after that. And that slough was all dried up, and them fish were dead, all laying dead there in that mud, and there was wild animals and ravens and everything that had been eating them. Now, you know, they helped to feed the other animals just the same. But I don't think I'd better tell you any more.
Were there many caribou up the Chattanooga in those days?
On the Chattanooga, we used to have lots of caribou in livestock, but they don't come there anymore.
I remember that. Tell them about the run.
No, their wives and people shooting them down. They just don't come.
Were there any up the Chattanooga when you were up that prospecting up there?
Well, you know, in the summertime, they scatter and they go all over. You might see one, but we didn't have to see any heat. We didn't have to get any heat at all. The only thing that my partner, this man that I went out with in early days, we run across caribou when we were up on the range, moving out towards, we moved into the beaver country over there. Mm-hmm. It's quite a big country, a lot of tributaries and lots of game meat over there. In fact, we got one game over there that was a little too much for us. We run across a grizzly, and it was very high up in the mountains. And you know, we try to get over the top of the mountain. As my partner said, he heard this bear snorting, and I said, well, we better leave our horse here. We had a horse packed up, and we left the horse stand there, and we thought we'd go on up around. And we got into a little crater right in the top of the mountain. And the bear was just over the horizon of the little dish, the hollow that we were in. And he circled clear around until he got around, and he's pretty near between us and the horse that was down the hill from us on where we come. And I had a brand new 30-40 rifle, and I was sure of my shot and everything else, but you know, these rifles are not always safe the way they have a duck-tailed shite in the end of the barrel, and coming through and over across the country, it must have got a clout against a tree or something and knocked it out a little bit. And I took a shot at the bear, and I was sort of very close to it. My partner says, he said, pretty near got him. He says, could see the fur coming out of it. But he ducked down and out of sight, and I thought he'd run down the other way. We didn't follow him up at all, but he must have seen the horse, and he come back away from the horse, up that maybe the shot come from the horse, and he come up over into this little crater that we was in. And the first thing he seen me, and all, he came right for me as hard as he could rip. And I had three shells that I had fired at him with a gun, and the fourth shell was in my pocket, and the other ammunition that I had was tied up in the horse. Well, I thought four shells would get a bear or anything anywhere when it was shooting good, but it wasn't shooting very good. And that bear was probably within 12 feet of me when I just pointed the last shot I put in that bear, knocked him down before he shot me. But I was running back, and when I turned back, I said, he's down. When I got as far as where my partner was standing, he said, I thought you were going to get this man. He says, I started to come towards you. And he had a gun that was just an old flint lock gun that he shoved in one shell at a time. Mine was new, but I said, I can't understand it, John. I said, I had a dead aim on that bear every time. And when I come to examine the rifle, he says, we'll try it out. You know, at the end of there was a rifle that had a little duck-tailed sight in the end. I guess some of the men here know about them. And you can hit them with a little tap of the hammer, you can move them. You know, they're duck-tailed in. And a little crack or a cloud again, a tree would knock them out, so you would miss pretty bad with them. But we seen lots of other grizzly bears, not lots of them, but... we left them alone, I tell you. You just will not shoot them if you hurt them, your lad.
Yeah. You know Jail Avenue good, of course.
I did, yes, sir.
And the Hudson boys. And
yes, I know Ted Hudson and Jim Hudson, and I know Cliff Hudson, but he came in later after the... Jim and Ted were the two old-timers, mostly.
They made the discovery of Avenue
today. Yes, they made the discovery, yes. But that same country was known by John Manuk and Weatherspoon, and they give my partner the information. They give Weatherspoon give Teddy Hudson information about that vicinity.
Weatherspoon of the Kill Island.
And yeah, we weren't near it. We were over in the Beaver, and the trail that they used to travel are pretty near the same trail that the road goes now. Hardly any difference, only they took a little more easier grades than we did. But all the boilers went over the hills where teams pulled them over, and they used to double up and triple up, and they'd pull the things up the top of the hill, and then they'd all go downhill with three little teams and double up the next hill. Everything went over the live wood fence, and everything went over there, over across this way.
Who put in the tram line there, Ben?
Yes, there was a tram line for to bring the freight from the what they call the terminal, about 12 miles below the Livingwood town. And that was built by the government for road funds to furnish that tram in there. I had a sawmill in there, and I had a contract to saw out a $5,000 contract for that tram, and I thought maybe they were going to keep it up, but it was only a year or two after that they... everybody would start to leave the camp, and the sawmills were burned down at West Fork, so I went up, and they had finished two or three contracts over there to finish a tram down to the terminal. And that was just a tram for an ordinary car, like, to run on.
With wooden rails, wasn't it?
Yeah, wooden rails.
Well, then... did they have a tram around the log jam down there too, or?
No, the log jam was about half a mile across, or I'd say three quarters of a mile maybe across. It was a jam at that far. The boats used to come up pretty good to that stand. But then on this side, they loaded it up as far as they could when it was high. The terminal was about 12 miles, what they call the terminal. That was as far as up as the smaller boat could make it after they crossed the log jam.
So that below the mouth of the West Fork for the terminal?
Oh, yes. That would be 5 or 6 miles below there. So we used to take that route in the wintertime with our teams when we freighted up stuff. We didn't have these hills to climb over here, and we went down by the Tolovana, and we only had one small hill to climb over about halfway down to the, what they call it, they didn't call that the log jam, they halfway. Log jam was further up. It's called about 20 miles from night and go down. And start up a low sloping hill, and that wasn't too bad for freight. Wintertime, you could haul a good big load.
Well, how did they get across that log jam? Did they have a road?
Yeah, they did. They had a kind of a tram there too, made out of poles.
Poles.
Yeah, they did haul something over with a leather wagon. I never was down there much in the summertime, and I went through there in the wintertime.
Well, did you know all the old-timers around Fairbanks here?
Yes, I know a lot of them. I really can't think of anybody right here right now. Eddie Farr is one of the oldest men that I met him here in spring of 1902. Mm-hmm. And he was... He was a boiler fitter that was putting in fluid in a boat with Kirkpatrick and Sharp, two men that had a trading post boat, and they just towed off the boat. They were putting fluid in the boiler right down there across the old Chino on that side of the river. That was in the spring in 1902. I know Ed Farr since that time. He'd been running down lower country, but I haven't seen him here for a long time. But he come and joined me last summer in the mine. I guess he mentioned that.
And you know Barnett and Bonifield and all those.
Yes, I know John Bonifield, Barnett,
Cleary,
and Healy, Dick Butch, and all those fellows. I know them all, and a good many more than two.
Any other questions? You think the
Ben, did you know Elam Harnett, Burning Daylight character, you know, story for
him? Who did he say?
Elam Harnett.
Well, I seem to me the name seems familiar, but I don't know if I may have probably did.
Burning Daylight, how is it you remember? He was
known
around
here
as
Burning Daylight.
I probably know. But did you know Frank Water, the Jap?
Yes, I know him. I knew him. He was the one that they were going to hang him away up here when he was coming back from Dawson. He got away from them. Oh, well, you know how people are. There's some crazy fellows like me there.
What did they want to hang him for?
Well, they thought he was lying about this stampede. And then we were coming back with him after he went to Dawson. He told them about it up there, you see. And he came back again. Well, there was a lot of them pretty mad about it because they just thought there was nothing here. But my partner went out there to the creeks and he said they only got 5 cent dirt. And didn't think it was worth staying for. But I'll tell you, it's been a wonderful camp, and it's been a what they call a pay street camp, and the pay is above the bedrock, 3 to 5, 4, 5, 6 feet of it, and it's a real genuine sandy pay settlement. You know, you can tell it the minute you stick your shovel in it. Boys, it feels different than any other dirt you can shove your shovel in. I don't know why, but whenever you sink your shovel in that kind of sand dirt, you'll sure feel the weight of it there a little heavier or something.
Did you know McCarty that discovered Fairbanks Creek?
Yes, I know Dan McCarty, the boy, and the son, and the old man.
Both. Well, the son died over in Livingood, didn't he?
Yes, he was shot over there by his wife. Well, I'm not throwing any reflection on anybody's wife here.
But, tell us about it.
Dan was pretty generous sort of a fellow, too, and mostly quite a lot of drinking when that happened, you know. The woman that he married, she was just as bad to drink as any of them, and of course, I guess he was pretty rough with her, but at least wasn't very far, just over the hill from where I was mining. Oh, I know it. He died before there was any help come to him. There was a nurse over there, too. She took care of him. She took care of him. And, you know, he was still talking long whether she'd give him probably a shot in the arm. That's because I know he said one thing. He says, if you want to get even with anybody, he says, just shoot him in the guts. That's where he got it.
Tell me, what kind of mining did you do on Ruth Creek? Are you
well, I've been doing a lot of hydraulic mining in my time. I've been using pipes and joints. I just used an automatic dam to break the ground open. It works pretty good yet. I started up on Wind Lily and quit there, and I thought I was going to do pretty good. Everybody thought I was in the money, but it didn't last long there. Then I didn't have any for another year or so. I got up on Roose Creek there, and I was sinking some holes, and I finally found it up on the benches. It's quite shallow. And I started a little ditch early in the spring so that I'd catch the snow water, and I started it with a pick, and I got the water to come out of the creek and run around and then down off into the creek again. And then the sun and the warm, little warm weather every day, it was so hot I could skim that out and made a little ditch, and the first thing I know, the water was running there and it started to cut down. And it started to pan all along in this ditch, you know. Oh, it was going on the ice, of course, couldn't stop, and so I decided to sink a couple of holes right down where it had a grate and was running fast and cutting down into it. So I sunk a couple of holes with the boiler and dropped them down about 4 feet. And then all this here ground that the water was cutting, the gold was dropping in these holes, you know. It started to pan pretty good in these holes, and there was some fellas that come up from town, see what we were doing, how we were getting along. And was he getting any gold? Oh, yes, a little bit, of course. Can they do a little panning? Why, sure, they'd pan on it. And they got, just told them to take a pan out of this deer ditch that was washing down. But we steered them where they could get a pan out of one of these holes where the gold would drop in, you know. Boy, they could get 50 cents and 75 cents a pan, you know. They went back to town, they told the town that we struck it rich up there, and every day there was somebody coming up there, and we'd let them pan sometime, wouldn't it? We'd let them pan this rich ground, you know. Everybody was giving me the glad hand, but then after that played out, they passed me up like a white chip, but I kept them going there. I kept it going there till I took $100,000 out of it. Well, I could.
Yeah, that's just the end. I have to change it if you want to.
Any other?